I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
I'm Leah Simone Bowen, and this is Podcast Playlist. I want to start today's episode off with a question. Do you have any lifelong dreams? Like when you were younger, what was the kind of life you imagined for yourself? Maybe it was to be a famous musician, or an astronaut, or an all-star athlete. Or maybe, as you've gotten older, you lost sight of that dream. Maybe it's taken a backseat to things like work, family, and what the millennials like to call adulting. If this sentiment sounds familiar, then this episode is for you. Today on Podcast Playlist, we're listening to stories about late bloomers. We're going to hear from folks who achieve their dreams later in life and about how it's never too late. Our first story is about a man named Eric Duncan Thorpe, or better known by his DJ name, Deke Duncan. In 1965, at the age of 20, Deke developed big dreams of becoming a radio DJ. One day, as he was scrolling through radio stations, he landed on Radio Caroline. It was a pirate radio station, and it sounded like nothing he'd ever heard before on the radio. Inspired, he tried to apply for a job at the BBC, but he was turned away by the receptionist. So he got to thinking, what if I run my own radio station? Then he created Radio 77, a DIY pirate radio station of his own that he ran out of a garden shed in his backyard.
Here to try and put a grin around your chin.
Radio 77's rating.
Thanks for tuning our way, and if you're listening in your car right now, thanks for the ride.
For 40 years, he really only had an audience of one. Until one day, things changed. Here's Snap Judgment with more.
We were kind of local celebrities there, really. These weird guys that have this radio station in a house.
A film crew from the BBC's Nationwide show, that's the British equivalent of 60 Minutes, came to film a typical day in the life of Radio 77.
Mrs. Duncan of Gonville Crescent, Stevenage, is doing her housework to the music of her favourite radio station. Right now, she's tuned into her favourite DJ.
Here to try and put a grin around your chin, a special hello, how are you, going out right now to Mrs. Teresa Duncan, 57 Gonville Crescent at Stevenage. How in the world are you feeling, my darling? It's 9:40 on 77. These are the OJs.
Teresa, wearing a very 1970s dress, is filmed leaving the house.
I'm going to the shops, right, Deke? Okay.
Radio 77's ratings could be in for a bad morning now that the station's entire audience has decided to go down the shops.
The TV people made up this story that we had done this purely to play for my wife. They thought that was a good angle.
Well, the interest in radio came from the pirates.
It wasn't actually the case. The case was we wanted to be radio DJs and we wanted this radio station there to be authentic.
My ultimate ambition would be to broadcast this to the rest of Stevenage. I'd like to share it with them.
But the appearance on Nationwide was not Radio 77's big break.
I don't think anybody was interested in it, to be honest. Nothing ever came of that at all at that time.
Radio 77 had fizzled out in the early to mid-80s. I was quite sad. Actually, I was very sad.
Deke worked long hours at his construction job. He and Teresa had three children. Life moved on. But there was a jaunty little jingle in his head that he just couldn't ignore.
I thought, there's nothing here in England for me as a radio jock. I'll just go to the fatherland.
He decided to take one more shot at becoming a disc jockey in America.
The land of the free, where music radio is abundant. We sold our house and they up sticks and off we went.
He had friends in San Diego, so that's where they went. Deke knocked on the door of every radio station he could find.
Two stations said that we'll take you on the graveyard shift, which was, well, you know, that's from midnight till 6 a.m., which I would have loved that. But the pay was just so bad.
The lady from the BBC had been right. Making radio is no way to earn a living.
I just went back home with my tail between my legs. You yourself imagine coming back from San Diego and landing in London in November. Everything seems so grey and dark. Yeah, it was a big come down.
Really, when we went to America, it was for what he wanted to do and it didn't work out. And then, you know, we came back and it was just terrible, to be honest.
Teresa had had enough.
He's done what he wants. His dream, whatever he's wanted to do for his life.
All that time Deke had been making Radio 77, she'd felt abandoned.
I was, yeah. Basically, we never spent any time together at all.
I would cut off all the outside world, and my whole world would be on the radio. It's really weird that it's only now that I'm an old man, that I realise how selfish I was.
After the divorce, Deke was alone, and all he had left were a handful of recordings from Radio 77.
Maybe a dozen on old-fashioned cassettes in my car. I must have left the car open one night, and somebody opened the door and helped themselves and took them. I wish maybe one day I could find out who that was and buy them back.
It was like the thieves had stolen the best years of his life. Now Radio 77 was truly, finally gone, just like his family. Deke packed away his records and hung up his headphones. And how old are you now, Deke?
It's 75 in June.
And how old do you feel?
I feel 12 and three quarters.
The woman Deke is laughing with in the background is his new wife, Pamela.
She's here now, yeah. Would you want her to take the air chair? Right.
Hi.
Deke and Pamela have known each other since they were teenagers. Back in the 70s, he even came to her house and taught her how to DJ.
The one phrase I remember is, what he taught me was, a very good evening to you one and all. This is yours truly, Pamela, stirring up a ball with a wailing pound of sound right here in the pretty city, good sound of the nitty-gritty.
They reconnected after Deke's marriage ended, and as hers was falling apart. All that remained of Radio 77 was a one-hour-long tape the thieves hadn't managed to grab.
I would dream about Radio 77. I would constantly have dreams. Very pleasant dreams about constructing the studio and going back into it, talking into the mic and editing the jingles. And I would tell Pamela, I would say, I've dreamt about Radio 77 again.
I thought, you know, if somebody steals it that much that they dream about it, then they should do it.
One day she said, well, why don't we just go and get some broadcast equipment and do the whole thing again? Why not? I'll do it in the garage. I had plans to build a soundproof room in the garage, but then one day I had this pain in my chest. I ended up on the floor, and Pamela, quickly and very level-headedly, she called 999. Actually, believe this, she called 911 first. She watches too much CSI. I was in the hospital within 10 minutes, on the theatre table.
They said to him if they hadn't succeeded in the 3 hours, that he would have died.
I had a near-fatal heart attack. They did all kinds of things to me, put stents in my arteries, and my life was saved. And I felt like a new man.
As soon as Deke recovered, he built the studio in the garage in his backyard.
This studio here feels very much like the studios on those pirate ships all those years ago. Very intimate. If you closed the curtains at the window, you could think that you were in a ship. It's rather cool.
Radio 77 was back.
This will get you moving. All right. That's so cool. Tanya Tucker.
This time, Deke set up two speakers for his wife, and Pamela listened every day.
You know, and he thought maybe I could read the news, which he schooled me in.
You don't read the news, you deliver it.
77 News with Pamela Duncan.
First, factual. Prime Minister Boris the Animal has announced his intention to remove all speed bumps from Britain's road system. Mr. Johnson says these devices do nothing more than damage our cars and strain our tempers.
Deke and Pamela were happy to keep Radio 77 to themselves. But that's not what happened. Instead, an almost magical sequence of events connected the Radio 77 shed with the BBC mothership.
Radio 77's ratings could be in for a bad...
After 45 years, the BBC put their video of young Deke Duncan in the 70s on Facebook.
Well, the interest in radio came from the Pirates, Radio Caroline.
A local DJ noticed the footage.
My name's Justin Dealey. I work for BBC Three Counties Radio in England. Here we had a man in a shed broadcasting to one person and not getting paid a single penny for doing so. And we had to find...
Justin then launched a massive manhunt.
I saw a message with an email address that it was bbc.co.uk. So I thought, oh, that's a real guy. That's not just some weirdo.
We found him. Here he is. Deke Duncan.
Deke, welcome. Justin invited Deke to be a guest on his show.
A bit older, but...
They replayed the old documentary.
My ultimate ambition would be to broadcast this to the rest of Stevenage. I'd like to share it with them.
Then the station manager came on air with a bombshell.
I want to offer you a one-hour special over Christmas on Three Counties Radio.
The BBC offered Deke his own show, giving him an hour during prime time on New Year's Eve.
That feels really nice. I'm absolutely, first time in my life, I'm speechless.
Though you can't hear it, he's clearly shaken and turns pale.
You better pass the tissues.
Deke recorded the show at home, in his studio. In the end, millions tuned in. Millions of real listeners. And now, without further ado, here it is.
Good evening. Welcome to the big, wide, wonderful world of Uncle Deke Duncan. I'm in the air chair for the next 60 minutes. My aim is to put a little grin on your chin, a smile across your radio dial.
Deke had been through it all. Marriage, divorce, a narrow escape from a maritime bombing.
It's made my life. I've broadcast Radio 77 via the BBC's transmitter. There were no producers and nobody waving a finger at me and saying, you must do this, must do that, mustn't say this, mustn't say that. Just go ahead and do it with the freedom that the Radio Caroline DJs had.
Step inside here, fellow. What have you got to say to me?
I knew the bride when she used to rock and roll.
Oh, you did?
I knew the bride when she used to rock and roll.
Okay. Tell us more. This is going to be interesting.
The dedication for Pamela was her favourite song, Maggie May, and I played my favourite album track, If I'm Sleeping.
If I'm sleeping, don't wake me up.
And the line is, if I'm sleeping, don't wake me up. But my interpretation of that is, if I'm dreaming, don't wake me up, which sums up my life. My whole life has been a dream, really. Whole life been in my imagination.
Sitting in his cosy studio in his backyard, Deke had finally become a professional DJ. It took him his entire life to do it.
I would say sometimes living the dream can be more enjoyable than realizing the dream. Live the dream, dude.
From PRX and KCRW, that was Snap Judgment. It's hosted by Glenn Washington. That episode was reported by Jeff Myesh, who also produced it with John Facile and Noah Rosenberg. The guest featured in that episode was DJ Deke Duncan. Have you ever dreamt of being on a game show? Or better yet, have you ever watched a game show on TV and thought, I could do better than these people? That's me all the time watching Price is Right. For a woman named Jean Westcott, her show was Jeopardy. She grew up in a large family with two brothers and five sisters. And along with their parents, they'd all gather around the TV together and watch Jeopardy. Jean says that her father brought out everyone's competitive side, so when they watched, they also played along and tried to be the first to shout out the answer. It was in the late 90s when Jean would audition for Jeopardy herself. She waited 18 months to find out if she'd be on the show, but never heard back. And so she auditioned again, and again, and again, and it's a cycle that went on for over 20 years. Until one day, she finally got the call. With more on that story, here's the podcast, This Is Love.
After auditioning for more than 20 years, Jean Westcott finally got the phone call. They wanted her to be on Jeopardy. She was told she would need to fly to California, but Jean was worried about COVID.
You know, I was like, you know, you're still nervous about going to the grocery store. You know, you're still nervous about, like, seeing your family. And I now, of course, this is when I'm going to be saying, oh, you need to get a hotel. You need to fly in a plane. So it was a little bit of the, of course, this is when. And then you also have the self-doubt. It's like, wait. They couldn't get anyone else, could they? You know, it's like this worked out really well. And I still kind of have that feeling. And so, you know, it's like I know I earned my spot, you know, but it's just one of these things where you're like, OK, they were desperate. And but I still wasn't going to. I was never going to say no.
How did you start preparing for the show?
It was the almanac again. And when I told my family that I was going to be on, like my siblings, my sister Beth said, you need to work on sports. And she asked me, what team has the first female manager? And I thought it was the Mets. And it was the Marlins. And my other sister was asking me about cocktail recipes because, you know, that's the kind of thing she thought I needed to practice.
So you had one sister calling you, telling you, saying, this is what is in a Manhattan. And another sister saying, got to figure out the sports. Did it feel like there was this whole community around you had been championing you for so many years that were now saying, oh, Jean, one more thing. Don't forget this. Book one, Genesis, is...
Yes. Yes, it was amazing. And that's I feel like I was living everybody's little dream for Jean. So it wasn't their dream, you know, but when anybody who was like truly loved me knew I loved this. And so they knew it was important to me.
In March 2021, Jean arrived at Sony Pictures Studios in Culver City. At the time, Jeopardy was going through a lot of change. The longtime host, Alex Trebek, had died the year before. He'd been the host since 1984 and hosted more than 8,200 episodes. While the producers searched for his replacement, guest hosts, including Anderson Cooper, Aaron Rodgers, and LeVar Burton, were going to fill in. What was it like walking out on that stage for the first time?
Surreal. The whole day is just, it's just step. You know, you can't take it in, you know, because you'll get overwhelmed. It was wonderful, terrifying, confusing, frustrating, all those things. And you're given a little COVID bag, and they had hand sanitizer and bring you into a room. We were in the room, the studio that where the audience would sit for Wheel of Fortune. And, you know, everything's all covered up. I could see the wheel, but it was all covered up.
Wait a second. Jeopardy and Wheel of Fortune happen next to each other?
Yeah, they're two studios right next to each other.
In real life, always?
Yeah, so it's not just on your television. Yeah, yeah, they're right next to each other on the Sony lot. Yep, and we found out who our host was going to be. We were all surprised because they were just announcing that day the next set of hosts.
Her host would be Dr. Oz.
And there was no audience, so we would be each other's audience at that point. I think they sweeten the sound to make people sound like they're clapping when instead of the, you know, however many people, I think there were like 17 or 16 people.
A book publishing professional from Woodbridge, Virginia, Jean Westcott.
And I think I stayed very aloof. Like I felt like I didn't let my nerves get to me.
In 2020, Kim Ng became the first woman general manager in Major League Baseball for this Florida team. Jean.
What are the Marlins?
Correct.
All right, 600 in Kim.
I really couldn't believe that one question that came from my sister who had been in that living room, you know, at this point almost, you know, 50 years ago or 40-something years ago. And that exact question, out of all the questions.
Brave 6-year-old Percival William Williams is known as Wee This from a book of nursery rhymes. Jean.
Who is Willie?
Yes, that's right. It's Wee Willie Winkie.
It was funny, like it's when you were playing for real, it took me a little while to realize I was playing for real. And I remember I felt like, wait, Gene, you're not doing the game you want to do. And so I started going for the clues at the bottom. I'm like, if I want to win, I have to start. Like, there was a point where I remember it clicked, and I was like, now.
Gene.
What is Eye of the Tiger?
Correct.
All right, 12-letter for 1,000.
Was it easier? I mean, was it harder than you thought? I mean, you've been playing for so long at home and in these auditions, but when you actually got up there and you had the buzzer in your hand, did you realize, well, this is really different?
You know, I think all those years of practice actually served me well. I all the time, I was comfortable about the game.
It's time for Final Jeopardy. Here's your category. American history. Please make your wagers. We'll be back with the clue after this.
So what were you going into Final Jeopardy with, and how much did you bet?
I was going in at like 12,000, which is healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I can't even remember the exact, but I had done pretty well. And I had, I bet it all. I wanted to win as big as I could.
Well, you'd waited long enough.
Yeah, yeah.
Welcome back. We're in Final Jeopardy. The category, American history. Here's your clue. While performing in Philadelphia, the future father of this man sent a letter threatening to slit Andrew Jackson's throat. You have 30 seconds. Good luck.
I was like, what family would be around to be both pissed at Andrew Jackson? And I didn't know Abe Lincoln. And I came up with George H.W. Bush.
The correct response was John Wilkes Booth.
Gene, let me go to you. You have $12,800. Were you able to find that response?
Nope.
George Bush. He wasn't that old.
H.W.
You wagered $12,798, which takes you to $2. Bryce, you have
$34,400. I knew I blew it, but I didn't think I would have been able to come up with it. I mean, that's the thing that if it was something that I just got the name wrong or I spelled wrong or I had was just like I named the wrong Beatle or something like that, that would have been disappointing. But I so brilliantly blew it. I was so wrong that I can't be mad at myself, you know. And it was like this exhale. And I was kind of proud of how badly I answered it.
After the show, Jean says she was exhausted. She called her family and broke the news that she didn't win. She drove around California, took pictures of Culver City, and flew home to Virginia the next day. The episode aired 6 weeks later. She watched it in her living room with her son and her husband. Her daughter was watching from Seattle. And when the episode ended, this thing that had been part of her life for more than 20 years was over.
I miss doing it so much. Like I would, you know, like everybody who's been on the show would be on it again in a minute.
We just heard an episode called The Contestant. It's an excerpt from the podcast This Is Love by Criminal Productions from Vox Media. It's hosted by Phoebe Judge and produced by Lauren Sporer. Their guest in that episode was Jean Westcott.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Beverly Glenn Copeland is a musician who's been quietly putting out albums since the 1970s. In 2015, a Japanese record collector emailed to ask if he had any more copies of his album, Keyboard Fantasies. Beverly went ahead and sent the man some records. But within a month of selling the records, he started getting calls from record companies. In this conversation with Anna Sale from Death, Sex, and Money, he discusses plans for touring his music and working on the famous Canadian children's show, Mr. Dress Up.
Suddenly, in his 70s, Glenn's career took off. And 2020 was supposed to be the year when all this new attention and opportunity was going to come together. A new documentary about Glenn was headed for film festivals, a new collection of his music was being released, and an international tour was planned. And then, of course, the tour was called off.
It was interesting because I really didn't have much time to think about the loss of the touring. I was so busy thinking about the loss of a home.
At the time, Glenn and his wife, Elizabeth, were also in the midst of moving. They'd already sold their old house, and when the projected earnings from the tour went away, they could no longer afford the place they'd planned to buy.
So we ended up being homeless.
That's how I first learned about Glenn's music. Producer Afi Yellowduke told me about a GoFundMe his daughter started that raised around $75,000 for Glenn and Elizabeth. Word spread quickly among his fans and people in the queer community who wanted to help out Glenn, a trans elder.
Almost 3,000 people from all over the world donated $25, $20, $30, whatever they could afford, and they were people who we knew were also going through difficult times as well, because everybody was going through uncertain times.
Glenn and his wife were also given a place to stay. When we first talked in 2020, Glenn was sitting next to his electric piano in a guest house overlooking the Atlantic coast in New Brunswick.
We were offered this place in June when we no longer had a home. It's absolutely stunningly beautiful.
Who offered it to you?
Two people married to each other, both international lawyers, a man and a woman, who had made a whole lot of money.
found out about our situation and offered it to us for nothing until we could find out, you know, until spring, at which point they considered that we would have found another home.
Wow. So these are people mm-hmm. you did not know previously?
Not at all.
And they said, we have this home on the coast, come stay here. What was that like, Glenn, when people you didn't know said, come stay?
I mean, it was a point of being stunned, actually, because my wife and I had been under such stress to have, you know, to essentially not know where we were going to live for, 5 months. They called it paying it forward.
Did that feel comfortable to accept for you?
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Totally. You know, if you can't accept a gift when a gift is being given by the universe, you got problems. Hello.
It was a gift from the universe, but it didn't solve their housing instability long term. As Glenn told me when we caught up just a few weeks ago.
We're living in our fourth temporary home since the pandemic and are currently in the midst of move number 5. Yeah.
Glenn described the last year as a wild ride. And he said he and his wife are still on the lookout for a permanent housing solution. We'll have more of an update from Glenn at the end of this episode. Before Glenn wrote and performed his own music, he studied classical singing and performance. He grew up playing piano in a Quaker home in Philadelphia. His family had a Steinway in the living room. He left to go to school in Montreal, where he was one of the first Black students to study music at McGill University. But after McGill, he realized he wanted to take his career in another direction.
I want to start to write music that incorporates the music from all over the world and many other cultures. That's what hit me. What I did was I took the guitar and I didn't know anything about anybody else doing this either. And I started retuning the strings, and every piece that would come to me would have a different tuning on the strings, and I'd have to retune the thing. And I played it with a pick as though it was a drum.
Did it feel, do you remember a feeling of fear as you were stepping away from all of those familiar slots?
Not even 1 ounce of it.
Really?
I don't know. I just went, oh, this is what I'm going to do next. And I did it.
Can you tell me about, like, what is it about you that you think makes it feel like not a big deal to say, like, there are all these like ways that people have done this before, but I'm just going to try something really different and not feel too worried about it.
I don't think I'm too sensitive. I really didn't think about I'm doing this because I want to create a career. It was a drive.
How were you supporting yourself with money at that point?
Oh, listen, I had no money. The first, money. Listen, when I started doing that, I had just finished breaking my foot off of my bone, literally. Yeah, I was in a full cast on one leg, not walking. The only thing I could afford was one little room that was on a second floor. I had to go up on my cast. I ate peanut butter. That's how I lived, peanut butter and sardines. And it was fine. Mm-hmm. I felt totally free. I wasn't afraid of it. It was just like, this is what it is. I'm free to like explore this. I'm going to explore this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I look on it now with great amazement. because youth is like, you know, the great thing about youth is that it isn't afraid of anything. And the difficulty about youth is it has no idea what it should be afraid of.
How did you begin your work in children's television?
I had a very dear friend, and she had a very good friend. And this good friend, she was a writer for this show. She got in touch with me and asked me if I would be willing to be on this program called the Mr. Dress-Up Show. She said, we'd love to have you on this show, and we're writing you in as a character, but we also would like it if you would write music for this show, for this particular episode. So I did, and I had just the most wonderful time. I was just like, oh, goody two-shoes. You know, I had to get dressed up in all these silly costumes, right? And I had to talk to these puppets who were, you know, were just amazing. And I wrote music for the show. Well, afterwards, they loved it so much that all the other writers started writing me in. And after a while, I became a character who was considered to be one of the neighborhood folks in the show. And I wrote all, you know, I probably wrote 100 songs for them. And 20 years passed by.
Wow, that's a large portion of your adult life.
Yes, it was.
What was like the thing you wanted to convey to a child who's watching?
I wanted to convey to children that what they were looking at was made them feel safe, made them feel loved, made them feel seen, not talking down to them, but engaging them in their own imagination.
That was Death, Sex, and Money from Slate. It's hosted by Anna Sale. That episode was produced by Afi Yellow Duke. Diana Nyad is a long-distance swimmer, and if her name sounds familiar, it's because a film was recently released about her 2013 swim from Cuba to Key West, Florida. That's over 150 kilometers. She attempted the swim for the first time in her 20s, but she completed the swim in 2013 during her fifth attempt when she was 64 years old. This clip comes from the podcast 70 Over 70, which profiles 70 remarkable people over the age of 70. At the time of this recording, Diana was 72 years old, and she speaks with host Max Linsky about what motivates her and the realities of getting older.
I wasn't necessarily going to share this, but I will tell you that on November 9th, 2020, after waking up every day the way I described it to you, feeling like a million bucks, I woke up with extreme 10 level pain in both shoulders, both groins, and the neck. It took me 11 or 12 minutes literally to get out of bed.
Holy
I thought,
shit.
Do I have ALS? Do I have MS? Is this lupus? But how could I have gone to bed last night 100% and wake up with something I just can't understand? So it took 3 weeks, but I was diagnosed with a fairly rare thing called polymyalgia rheumatica. And I'm doing a lot better now. I'm back to playing tennis, but this is my first little hint that I'm only human. If I do live to 90 or 100, I'm gonna go through decline. It's been hard for me to learn. I used to think my will can overcome anything. But this little polymyalgia rheumatica has sort of taught me to say, I'm going to see that I'm going to go through things. I'm going to go through some degeneration of body and or of mind, and I better just get some grace with it.
Sounds like you've done a lot of work to process it in a classic Diana fashion, like just attack the thing. But tell me a little bit more about what those 11 or 12 minutes were like when you couldn't get out of bed.
I was scared. I called Bonnie. Bonnie Stoll, by the way, is my best friend for 40 years now. And I used to be her trainer. And then many years later, in my 60s, she became my trainer. But she came over. And by the time she came over, I was standing up, but barely walking. And I I catastrophized. I went to the point like, this is never going to get better. This is the way I'm going to live from now on. This is life for me now. I went from being badass to debilitated overnight.
Hmm. When you say you catastrophized, does that mean panicked?
Yeah, I was in a bit of a panic. And I will say that that's one negative trait I've had. You know, you could, people think of, oh, you're so positive. You think you can do everything. No, I worry about everything before it happens. But Bonnie's always saying to me, it's good to be prepared, but don't get stuck on what if this happens? And what if that happens? And what if I lose? And what if I don't make it? And what if I, just stay calm and realize that that might be one of the outcomes. You're losing or you're not making it or you're failing and you'll deal with that. But don't sit in a place of what if, oh my God, that's probably what's going to happen.
Right. There's something about the way you're describing it, right? Searing pain, unable to move, that feels so reminiscent of your worst moments in the water.
No.
Well, from the outside, right, being stung by those box jellyfish, yeah. Or just being unable to move, vomiting, your body giving out. When you just told me that story, all I was thinking about was these descriptions of you on these epic swims. But did it not feel that way to you? Did you panic in the water?
No, maybe during the box jellyfish, I thought, am I going to die here? Is it because I was really having trouble breathing? The whole professional medical team, University of Miami, ER doctors were having trouble reviving me. We weren't sure. And many people have died being stung. It's called the Irukandji syndrome.
Right.
But honestly, I never actually panicked. I let the team take over. And as soon as they revived me, I was ready to get back in the water, even with the box jellyfish there. I think there's a resolve when people are set on, you know, an astronaut going into that capsule and going out of space, as much as their family might say, it's not worth it. It's not worth it. You're dying. That astronaut is not going to panic. They believe in all the intelligent protocols and the preparation that's put together. And so I was never in a state of panic out in the ocean.
Right. I guess I'm just trying to poke my finger at like what was different on November 9th, you know, and when you're in the ocean and getting stung by these prehistoric creatures, you'd chosen to be there. And on some level you were in control. But when you woke up on November 9th, there was no choice and no control.
Actually, I had trained hundreds and hundreds of hours off the Key West coast and off the Cuban coast and never been stung by a box jellyfish. So, you know, the box jellyfish was unknown, but mm-hmm. I had this state of resolve, whereas this polymyalgia rheumatica, I mean, I didn't have a moment of a symptom to sort of get me, you know, ready for, hey, something weird's happening.
Comes out of nowhere.
Yeah. And, you know, I wasn't saying to myself, oh, this is nothing. You know, you don't worry about it. Get up. You'll make a couple of phone calls. I was like, I'm this is going to get worse and I probably won't live another 24 hours. That's where I was that morning.
Right. And then you find out it's not Lou Gehrig's disease. You're not paralyzed. It's treatable. And yet, you know, like, who knows where you'll be at 81 or 91? Who knows when's the next time you wake up in the morning with something hurting in a way it never has before? And I wonder whether you feel now ready for those moments or whether you're scared of not being able to control, not knowing physically what's coming for you.
I don't think it's a matter of being scared. I think it's a matter of getting real. You know, there's very little physically I won't do out in the ocean or on a bike or running or whatever it is. But I have to, you know, forget about the cosmetics. Sometimes I'm just shocked to look at photos and I see my breasts are like 5 inches lower than I think they are when I walk around. But if things happen, If things happen beyond your control that your will are not going to overturn, then it's time to get real. Can I come up to this? Can I get over this? Or is this not going to be gotten over and I got to live with it? So I wasn't sure in those first 3 weeks after November 9th. And I was thinking, I certainly can't swim. No way I could bring the shoulder over this way. But I was starting to not be angry about it. Even in the throes of those 3 weeks of pain, I wasn't saying, I don't want this. Take this back. I'm going to overcome it. I'm going to get down and make myself do push-ups. I was getting real with it, like find out what it is, deal with it. You know, you're going to be okay no matter what it is. But I think all of us have to use our will when we can push and get real when we're going to have to settle. And it's a hard word for me to use, but I think all of us come to that at some areas of our lives.
Yeah. You know, I watched the documentary, The Other Shore, and you said that you hope to have enough dignity and maturity to recognize when enough is enough. And in a way, I feel like that quote touches on a lot of what we've talked about today. But I wonder how you think you'll know when you've hit that point and how you'll know when to let go. Do you think you'll be able to do that?
Yeah, I do. You know, because I think that, you know, we evolve slowly. So I didn't come to this point today, you know, overnight. I didn't go from 21 to 71 overnight. You know, I couldn't have said at age 21, yeah, if things slow down or, if, you know, I have some amount of debilitation or if I just don't get lucky in certain ways, I'll be able to accept it. I wasn't in that place. And I've learned since then that you know, that the universe is bigger than we are. And bad luck does factor in to everything we do, as well as good luck. So I think that, you know, I'm at a space now in life that if something absolutely beyond my control, you know, happens, if my house burned down tomorrow and I lost all the possessions in it, you know, I can't say, whereas I might have at age 21, that didn't happen and I'm going to build it back tomorrow and I'm going to go in the ashes and find everything that's important. I would just say, take a deep breath. This is reality. Let's get with it. You know, heroism and tremendous deep resilience aren't born because you want those to be your characteristics. They're born because of unexpected events and how are you going to react to them? So I think that I'm going to be able to, you know, handle anything that comes my way in life, but I'm not saying I'm going to, you know, go down gently if it doesn't go the way I want it to go.
And you wonder why people get on the phone with you and ask you about how you have so much confidence.
Yeah.
That was 70 Over 70 from Pineapple Street Studios. It's hosted by Max Linsky. It's produced by Jess Hackle. In that clip, we heard from marathon swimmer Diana Nyad. We've come to our last story today. It's told by someone younger than the folks we've heard so far, but it's universal to any late bloomer kind of story. I feel like I should be here, but I'm not. So how do I get there? In this clip from Grown, a podcast from The Moth, storyteller Lou Levin describes her senior project, becoming an adult.
At the beginning of my senior year of high school, my English teacher tells the class that we're going to set aside one day a week to ignore our course curriculum and just work on an individual project of our own creation and design. So some kids are like researching politics, some want to make the world a better place. I decide that I'm going to spend September to June learning to be an adult. And I'm going to embark on that cultural journey by making a list of adult tasks and completing them one by one and seeing if I feel more mature after. So essentials on my list included things like cooking a meal, reading the newspaper, listening to NPR. And it all sounded so simple, and it seemed like it would be so useful. I was going to go to college in August. I was like, growing up seems really hard. Let's expedite this process, get it out of the way. But senioritis hits, and I don't do a single thing all year, which would have been fine, but the end of the year meant that I had to present my final project to my class, and I had no proof of my personal growth at all. So I say, okay, I have to do something big. I'm gonna throw a dinner party. And I ask my parents, okay, you know I'm doing this project. I've really put it off for a while. Do you mind if I use the first floor of our house to throw a dinner party? And they say yes. And they're gonna eat takeout upstairs during the meal like adults do. But I don't know that yet. So I text all of my friends and I say, all right, guys, I'm on an academic deadline to grow up and we're coming on the last like week and a half. It's May. So I'm gonna cook a 3-course meal, come over. It's gonna be the cultural event of the school year. Please dress business casual. And after an afternoon of cooking, all of my friends file in their button-up shirts and their dresses and their skirts, looking like the young professionals I dreamed of having at my table. And the dinner went pretty smoothly, but I was a stressed host. I got really nervous when Vishal looked like he really didn't like the arugula salad that I made. I nearly burned my garlic. A friend asked if I wanted help plating when I was in the weeds, and I said yes, but in my head I was like, you really don't understand the point that I'm supposed to take on too much and still get it all done. At one point, my senior prom date, who was very smart, asked if we were only allowed to talk about world affairs and cinema and things like that during the meal. And I was like, oh, in my head, I was like, I haven't read the New York Times these past 9 months like I said I would. We can't do that. And I was like, no, let's not pretend. We're still in high school after all. Ha ha. Who's enjoying things? After everyone left, I experienced a type of joy that I think you really have to grow up to understand. Having leftovers in the fridge and getting to be alone after hours of not having that. So my piece de resistance was finished, but then I needed a rest of a year of proof, and thus began my frantic afternoon of putting together lutriesadulting.tumblr.com, featuring posts like, why we should all know the different cuts of beef on a cow, and how listening to Ira Glass bridged the cultural and generational divide between my parents and I. I remember sitting frantically at my computer keyboard, thinking of friends that had told me they'd gone through hard times and had to grow up quickly. And I was gonna present to my class in like a day and a half. I was like, I know exactly what they mean now. I ended up getting a 90 on my project. Thank you, big win. And now 4 years later, I'm about to graduate college. And I kind of wish that younger Lou had given her tasks a little bit more thought. I wish I knew how to budget better. I wish I knew how to take care of myself better. But I also think back to one of the things that younger Lou said during her presentation and speech to the class after everything was over. She cited the definition of adult, which was a person who was fully grown and developed. And she said, you know, if an adult is a person who's fully grown and developed, like, I never want to be an adult. I want to keep learning. There's so much growth to be had. I just need to keep going. And maybe I just don't have my together right now. Probably. But I still see a little bit of truth in that. And honestly, When I think back on it, younger Lou actually did one of the most adult things she could have done when she was a senior in high school. She was lying about feeling like a grown-up for as long as she could without getting caught. Thank you.
From PRX and The Moth, that was Grown, hosted by Aliza Kazmi and Fonzo Lacayo. And the story you heard was by Lou Levin. Grown was produced by senior editor Sarah Jane Johnson, senior producer Mark Solinger, and the rest of The Moth team. Well, I don't know about you, but I'm feeling inspired. I think after this, I'm definitely going to try to become an astronaut. I've been putting it off over the years. And those are really all the late bloomer stories that I have for you today. If you like what you heard, please follow us on Spotify or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. It really helps us out. And if you have any podcast recommendations for us, we'd love to hear about them. You can email us at podcastplaylist@cbc.ca or find us on Facebook at CBC Podcast Playlist. Podcast Playlist is Kelsey Cueva, Aili Yamamoto, and Julian Uzielli with technical support from Laura Antonelli. Our senior producer is Kate Evans. Our executive producer is Cecil Fernandez. I'm Leah Simone Bowen. Dream big and catch you next time.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.